evening. Francis sends her hellos. She's on her way to Mooramara, apparently, which is the Kenyan side of the Serengeti. Have you been? You know where that is?
I know where Serengeti is, but I've never gone there.
Anyway, that's where she is today. She said she's. Yesterday she reported three lions in a tree, two leopards in a acacia, and a female cheetah with two cubs eating some kind of animal, other animal, non-vegetarian cheetah. So she's having a good time. She'll be back next week. First thing. So I contacted the author. Remember last week I talked about the nice sugar study with a waiver of consent down in Australia, and because they didn't break out their presentation of how many refusals they got in Canada versus down in Australia and New Zealand. It was really kind of ambiguous. So I emailed the guy and he responded. So it turned out that they, in Canada, they approached 1,291 people, of whom are really not the patients, because the patients were really out of it. But they're living related people, and 535 people refused. So overall refusal rate was 41%, which is pretty high. He also said that the consent rates varied dramatically. He said they had 17 sites in Canada. The consent rates varied from 21% to 88%. And it's like, well, what makes the difference? Is it people, or is it actually, I bet you it's the staff. How dedicated are the staff, and how good an approach do they do? And do they give people an opportunity to kind of like say no? Do they kind of, you know, how much of an opportunity do they give them to say no? I did a study some years ago where I had two research coordinators, and they were basically approaching people who were giving blood or doing autologous blood, giving cells. So they're hooked up for a long time, and they're just going in and talking to them. And their participation rate varied by 20 points between the two. One had a 90% and the other one had a 70% participation rate. And it was purely that the one person, who was this woman who became a lawyer, she was like, take charge, no nonsense, kind of, she just steamrolled these people, right? And the other guy was very kind of like very considerate and very quiet and meek and kind of mild mannered, and I'm sure he said if they at all looked like they wouldn't do it, he'd just kind of back off. So where's consent in all of this, right? But I did ask him. I went back and I asked for what the refusal rate was in Australia and New Zealand. He hasn't responded yet, since they didn't really give the number approached. I guess I could subtract it from the totals, maybe. But what you don't know is how many were actually asked in Down Under. All you know is that how many were enrolled. So there were refusals. Anyway. What else? So the paper I gave you is just a follow-up, kind of a recent one on the Yamamoto. That was the general. how do you say that word? Yanomami. All right. So, what do you think? Yanomamo. We've had a lot, basically tonight's a whole series of different cases, plus a couple thought papers, which we can criticize. Any thoughts about any reactions to the Yanomamo paper?
I wonder why Venezuela's not asking for their. I mean, they said it was based upon the. 10 years ago, after the publication of *The Darkness* in *El Dorado*, how scientists and journalists devastated the Amazon. So the people in Venezuela didn't read that book.
They do suggest an answer to you, and it's that the NGOs are rabble rousing, or were trying to get people to.
I was sort of shocked by the tone of the researcher. I mean, obviously he was very defensive. But, I don't know much of the history of this of all of that. I've only read that article, but, mm-hmm. But it'd be interesting to find out how he came to that point. And
which point?
Or just the fact, I mean, the article, I guess, was written for regular consumption. It didn't seem like an academic article, right? It was a...
Which one?
The Newsweek piece? Yes.
Also,
it was a Newsweek piece.
Yeah. It's a book review, right? More or less. Kind of describing the controversy.
Right. So as such, it was quite provocative. But then his responses to everything that was asked of him, the researcher, I forget his name, the scientist, his tone was shocking. So...
Would you expect anything different? I mean...
Not given what he's alleged to have done.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what to make of it. I mean, coming out of that, I mean, does anybody know about this story? Anybody? I don't either, and I don't know the truth of it. I could have asked Susan. So Susan Lindy is here, and I could have asked her. I should have had more time. What her take on it? Apparently, she was derisive of the critique. I mean, what that's worth. So that, you know, even the critique is somewhat questionable, I guess. Would it shock anyone to find that a scientist or an anthropologist might color their data and their presentations?
No.
I mean, it's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little scary.
It actually speaks to the last paper as well. The last paper we read tonight is an anthropologist. I mean, because essentially, you know, the guy mentions this action research, and the idea that there's a kind of a slippery slope moving into advocacy for anthropologists who become embedded in their communities, and you can see why they do it, right? It's a kind of a natural human response, probably, but it definitely affects their objectivity.
I mean, people forget too sometimes that science is embedded within a certain, you know, within a value system. You know, sometimes it can move in one direction or another. It's not completely always objective.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that people think science is neutral. This is sort of proof that it's not really neutral.
Right. Well, none of it is. Even genetics. I mean, genetics has there is a tying theory, right, that helps people interpret the data that they gather. And heaven forbid you should ever collect something that kind of like calls that underlying theory into question. I had an interesting email with a guy who's now in the IRB world, but some years ago he was a geneticist. And he said he did a study, I forget what it was, but it basically, his interpretation of the study was that it was inconsistent with everything else we know about genes and how they function. And it was published, and people choose to ignore it. And if anybody wants more detail, the science is way beyond me, but I could reconstruct that conversation. And he wound up kind of getting into genetics. I'm not sure if this had anything to do with it, but it's fairly interesting.
But there's a subtle difference between, not so subtle difference, I should say, between, you know, sort of being embedded in a certain paradigm, you know, if you may, which focuses your science or your interpretation of the science versus just sort of outright, you know, fraud, if you may. There's a difference there. So, but sometimes that's open to interpretation. So, you know, did this guy really stage this? Or is that somebody just sort of looking that had a different way of sort of seeing the whole thing and interpreted what he was doing as staging?
Right. But it's a selection. Anytime you have data, unless you're, I mean, do we ever present all of our data? Right? There's always selection that goes on.
True.
And here, you know, I mean, especially if he's an advocate, then he has a reason to kind of like promote some one or particular view. I don't know how this would serve his interests in coloring these people as being more violent than they otherwise might be thought to be.
Well, maybe he was just sort of selecting what he thought was a novel observation to make his career better. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the conflict of interest there sometimes.
It's true.
Yeah.
But their selection of data and their selection of data that's patently misleading. There's that episode about the video about how one of the camera people was sort of sham attacked by one of the Yanomamo, and then he backed off and said, "Oh no, I'm just kidding."
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they don't show that part.
They don't show that part.
You can't edit.
So the whole thing is posturing and actually fighting.
Mm-hmm. And the beating of a child as well.
And the beating of a child.
I thought one of the reasons they might have done that was to seeing what happened when he tried to present his research, and there was an objection to it when he was trying to actually present it to an audience. I'm thinking maybe he did it to avoid competition. Maybe it's sort of to keep other researchers out so he could have it all to himself.
Send a warning sign to them. But it's funny, in some ways, what is his obligations to the truth and to kind of protect the community as well? In some ways, kind of painting a bad picture of them that wouldn't seem to serve them in any way. And I was wondering, so why is this paper here? Why is it included? Because we're talking about benefits tonight. What is it? Why is this here?
The benefit of conducting research among the Yanomamo, I guess. What is the benefit to them?
Yeah.
They understand who they are. I assume. Or have some understanding of who they are.
In what way?
I mean, if we're talking about what their for behavioral science and sort of social science research, I'm not sure 100%, but I'm pretty sure the Yanomamo know why they engage in various kinds of ritual acts or what they do.
I'll just argue that, but others may not, and they might be interested in understanding.
No, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't ever advance knowledge in any meaningful way. But the question is, what the kind of study that was described in that article, how does that meaningfully advance knowledge, both for the group and for us in general, if it's conducted that way?
Okay.
I mean, I'm trying to answer your question. Why was this included in here?
So what's the? I mean, we're interested in benefit, and so the benefit obviously is knowledge to the outside world. Right, that there is this cult kind of culture and these people, how they survive and blah, blah, blah. But what's the benefit to, are we allowed, just because we're interested in studying them, what have we been talking about all semester, about kind of like that the questions have to be relevant and important and prioritized by them, for them, and there has to be some flow of benefits to them. What do they get out of this?
And we can't talk about benefits without risks. So what risks are they exposed to as a result of participating in this benefit to us?
I can see some risks here.
Right, and then you could look at the other dynamic, is where I was sort of going with it. Who benefits from this? Do they benefit from this, or do the researchers benefit from this?
Right.
So it,
Well, the researcher clearly benefited, right? Like clearly. The career thing.
Exactly, so that, there's this inherent, sort of conflict always between, what's the focus of the research and benefits, who benefits from it?
Mm-hmm.
That's where sort of the check and balance needs to be.
So how do we offer benefit when we're trying to go in and study a people like this? How do we offer benefit? It's not medical, right? This is purely, we're trying to understand how what's the lived life of the Yamamo. I'm never going to get this right. It's too close to the Japanese general. Yamamoto. What do they get, or what should they get out of it?
Well, the first thing they should get is no harm.
Yeah.
That's the first thing they should get out of it.
Should be them as you find them,
right?
To a certain extent.
Which is always very difficult, because for any scientific intervention, if you're going to measure something, you always perturb
change.
It. So that always happens no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
No harm.
Right, respect them and leave them no worse than they were prior.
Is that good enough? We are taking something from them. Mm-hmm. Leaving them no worse the right standard? And can we leave them no worse? Can we even say what worse is?
Right. No, I agree with you. I think there should be some sort of benefit, but I think the step number one is no harm, right? And then sort of what could the benefit be that makes this socially worthwhile for everybody?
This doesn't appeal at all to beneficence, and I found it interesting that even the supposedly clear-cut benefits, such as metal fishing hooks and so forth, were actually clearly detriments to the relations with other tribes. So interesting how the fairly obvious benefit, or at least what you would think would be a benefit, turned into a clear harm or risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which, you know, the funny thing about risk, of course, is that it's not necessarily foreseeable.
Right.
And in some sense, while I'm trying to do good here, although I'm giving trinkets and like little useful things, and the untold, the unforeseeable side effects. So then do you have to mitigate those? And in what ways?
Also the challenge with it, oh, go ahead. The challenge with this too that I was thinking of is, I mean, just, I was trying to think of how one would conduct this research properly or a project like this with an undiscovered tribe. And it's kind of like you get caught in this circular trap almost where you need to do the research to know how they could benefit from the research, mm-hmm. but you know, you want to do the research while providing potential benefit, obviously, like trying to comply with the guidance documents. And it's, I mean, it's very challenging to think of how you could benefit a tribe that you know literally nothing about or very little about.
Mm-hmm. Brooke? But it's not like it hasn't been done. I mean, this just seems to be an extremely egregious example of mm-hmm. someone who took a vote. So.
Well, it depends what the truth, where the truth is, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's true.
But it's also, I mean, one interesting question though is, even if he was truthful, could it be damaging to the reputations to kind of publish that abroad? I mean, do we have an obligation to protect subjects from themselves and their own reputational? I don't know. It's not reputational harm, but it's in a way it is. I mean, because their reputations, they're not really known. And putting that information out there could be damaging to them in a way, right? Because now they become known, or this attribute of the population becomes known. But it is, even if it's truthful, doesn't mean it's not harmful. Or does it?
Well, I mean, that's contextual too. I mean, harmful in what sort of way, in what context, who's judging whether it's harmful or not.
Mm-hmm. Could be very beneficial. May keep people out of their midst purposefully. It might work to their benefit.
I mean, someone may think it's a source of pride to be considered very aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Brooke?
Yeah, what I wanted to say that these papers found that this research when they are well knowing that these people kill each other, but still they are providing them with machetes.
With what?
Machetes, it means arms. Yeah, it's like he was giving them arms to continue killing each other, mm-hmm. which for me, I find that the study actually itself was creating more risk for them instead. And I don't find any benefit which they could get from the study, because this person was just to know to study their genetical background, mm-hmm. and to look if there is any relationship with the killings, while you give them other arms to kill each other. So,
well, a machete, I mean, could I justify a machete just like the fishing hooks? I mean, they basically live by cutting down leaves and using them for their huts and for growing grubs and other purposes.
But so for me, I could think if we wanted what is beneficial for them, we could ask them what they needed, mm-hmm. instead of imposing them with this is the chief that brought to you. Probably they needed other things more than that which he provided them. Mm-hmm. Because you can see this is the one which created more hostility among the community.
Mm-hmm. I would argue even if they asked for machetes and metal hooks, I might still say, okay, are there other things that you might need aside from machetes and metal hooks? Mm-hmm. You know.
So are those things benefits? How do we characterize things that we give people to participate that are I guess in some of the papers later kind of talk about these things that are kind of ancillary to the research. I mean, should the benefit flow from the research to the community?
Yeah, like at the IRB, it's not a benefit to get paid to take part in the research. That's not considered a benefit. If people list that as a benefit, obviously you'd have to take it out. So I don't know that can really be considered a benefit that you get this if you let us study you.
But why?
Because that's really a compensation for their time and effort and a benefit. I mean, I think the benefit should be something that actually occurs to them and helps them in some way, not just getting something.
So there's two kinds of ways that you can kind of consider compensation. One is compensating you fairly for your time, and the second part of it could be an incentive to participate. An incentive, arguably, isn't merely compensation. It's actually giving you something of value, which is good, right, to entice you and make it on net, even though there's maybe risk and discomfort and uncertainty and whatever, and risk in a study, the incentive makes it profitable to you. All those things weighted out.
Doesn't that change? I mean, over time, those things, incentives can change.
Right. Somewhat problematic. I mean, incentives for participation in a particular study. If you change them, I don't know how you guys feel about that.
If there's a rationale for it. If you went from giving somebody $50 to giving someone $200 because you wanted to increase enrollment, that way should be.
I'm thinking when you say
incentive. Well, it's not compensation, though. See, that actually proves the point.
Yeah.
Because there are studies where it's like, well, we're going to pay $50 and we're not getting high enough enrollment. We're going to increase the emolument, and therefore it's going to entice more people. We'll get faster enrollment.
So
that's purely an incentive. We want more people. In fact, we know in the U.S., we pay people. We pay women $5,000 for their eggs, $5,000 to $80,000 for their eggs. We'll pay, if you want fast enrollment, you just pay more. And if the professional guinea pigs know what's being paid by whom and what they can get where. So it's a market.
But to take that to a developing country context requires some adjustment in thinking, right? Because the compensation and incentives work very differently.
Right. But in some sense, I mean, it's looking at the fishing hooks and machetes, I don't think it's compensation, is it? I mean, compensation would be extremely minimal in this context, would seem.
They're inducements, if anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And inducements are allowed.
Right.
For continued access, maybe.
It's also, the gift giving, as a gift, it's the greatest tool for building relationships, friendships. I mean, bring food and bring fishing hooks and you're in like Flint.
But you're talking about benefits, I view that as a more of a long-term value that you transfer because of the long-term value that you, the researcher or the sponsor, is gaining as a result of the study. Mm-hmm. An intangible, one is getting an intangible and sometimes a very tangible value out of the research. Mm-hmm. And I sort of see benefits as a more long-term good that you leave behind rather than a one-time compensation or even a one-time inducement or incentive.
And SIAMS requires that, right? I forget which guideline now, but SIAMS pretty much requires it in developing or limited resource countries. SIAMS says that it can be guideline 10, that it can be carried out in limited resource countries if it will be made reasonably available for the benefit of that population or community. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., you can do research with no benefit, but you just have to say there's no benefit to you, at least in a consent form, depending on the risk level, obviously. Mm-hmm. So,
and there's a rationale for that, because ultimately the benefit somehow will, we understand, like, it will
right.
go back to you.
Right.
I'm not saying I buy that, but it is a rationale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What happens if you had evidence, we'll get into this later, but what happens if you had evidence that suggests that the participants of research are generally of lower economic means than across the board of the research portfolio that's done in this country? Let's say we're not doing it on the rich, it's the burden falls mostly on people with less means. Would we come to the same conclusion?
Like your anthrax vaccine trial in children. Mm. No.
Good point. We'll talk about that. Okay. So anyway, any other observations about this? The issues that come up now. Let me try to find out more about that for next time.
I didn't have a chance to read the article we just handed out, but it seems like the Yanomamo were making some demands based on, I guess, guidance from non-NGOs. The Have a Supply article also talked on this a couple of times about how the tribes are in a position to negotiate their rights because they have a lot of money from casino gambling. As it mentioned at least a couple of times, and I think the article was trying to be neutral about it, perhaps, but there's this whole issue of it's sometimes looked at askance that somehow, you know, you're coming and asserting your rights where before you were sort of unaware of it until we came into the picture, because whereas I sort of view it as they had the rights to begin with, and in certain circumstances it's easier or the framework is in place to be able to assert those rights by engaging lobbyists or a lawyer or whoever. But the Have a Supply article, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that one right, but that seemed to indicate that a couple of times. Just as they have a lot of money now, so they can bring these sorts of.
I was just going to say they didn't kind of connect the dots, but when I went to this conference, they spoke about how it's a sensitive issue because of the, depending if you're not Native American enough, you don't get to take part in the profits of casinos and stuff. So this article didn't connect the dots because they did just mention it and didn't say that. That's kind of what was in the back of my mind. I don't know if that maybe they meant to bring that in, but that can definitely be an issue, I think, for a lot of this genetic type of research, especially the one about like the European and Native American interbreeding that they were studying.
Sensitive to.
Yeah, it can be sensitive because they'll lose their benefits if they don't have a certain amount of, you know, Native American
genetics. Right, it's actually calculated down to the science of variety, which is why the senator in Massachusetts got into trouble.
Right.
Senatorial candidate.
Senatorial
candidate. Yeah.
Maybe that's the standard. Are you Native American enough that you can collect?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I meant for the Senate.
Oh, for her to get to get into college or whatever. Yeah.
So we talked about it. I think I talked about this case a little bit before. This Nature piece probably doesn't go into as much detail as some other papers that have summarized it more fully. And if anything, it comes across as a little bit more fair and balanced or something, but I don't think it really presents some of the issues. The interesting thing, if you looked at the consent form that I sent around last night, it basically says it's an early consent form, it's from the 90s. Sometimes when you look back at consent forms even from 15 years ago, you have to really shake your head and think, what were these people thinking? That was what really minimalist consent form. I didn't send it to you. I can get you one, because you're not on my list. But it did say that it was kind of approving for behavioral and medical research. It was extremely broad in the consent form itself. But apparently there was negotiation, and that doesn't really show up in this paper, that said they would not do it in psychiatric. They would not look at psychiatric problems. There was an agreement up front, and then apparently the researcher had placed somebody in the local clinic, and surreptitiously he collected data on psychiatric and mental illness. And then they wound up looking at that, and of course they didn't find anything, fortunately, I guess. But then they, of course, the real problem, they didn't look, I guess, they didn't look at interbreeding kind of genes, but they did look at gene flow, and basically they found that these people were consistent with others who had migrated from the east, and that was really undermined their story that they had emerged whole cloth from the stones to protect the environment. And if you'd ask them, they would not want that research to be done. So they were basically approving. They agreed to diabetes research. That was it. You know. But this and the other article kind of turn on. You know. So what is the? I mean, who owns the samples? You know, they've given in each case these people back in the 60s, I guess, for the, I'm never going to get that word right, the Brazilians. they gave blood freely. These people gave blood freely. And, you know, the funny thing is our rules basically say what? Once you've kind of given things like this up, they're there, they're available. I mean, data is available. We don't have an obligation to destroy data necessarily, and we don't have an obligation, and we can use data for secondary purposes, secondary research purposes, with certain protections. And blood and other stuff has been treated the same way. And something's changing, and I'm not sure what it is. And it's somewhat reflected in these two cases where people say, well, you know, you've got this stuff on us and we want it back. In some case, the
Yanomama.
Sounds like a type of sushi to me. I'm confused.
I'll get this in earlier. Genetic research, almost. I mean, at some level, like blood samples are blood samples until there's something special about the blood samples from a group of people, and maybe with tribes or protected individuals like that, we're seeing for the first time people making demands based on the fact that, hey, you're going to find something interesting based on our group characteristics from these blood samples, so therefore we have more of a right to them than generally. The general understanding is once you give blood or samples based on the consent form now.
Yeah, but they're not actually asking. I mean, in some sense, they're not asking for the financial benefits of whatever it is you've discovered, right? I mean, there have been cases, and I've got the patents here if anybody's interested in them, there have been cases where we patented either individuals, cell lines from individuals. There is the famous line, and all the bioethicists around the table will remember John Moore in California. He had hairy cell leukemia that went into remission back in the late 70s. And a guy named his doctor at UCLA. Anybody know this? Everybody know this story or no? Yeah, some yes, some no. Say no. Say no if you don't know it.
No.
Okay. So John Moore was diagnosed with hairy cell leukemia probably in 1975 or so, and he underwent treatment, and he got his spleen taken out, and his doctor at UCLA tried to take his create a cell line, and he wound up creating a cell line, and in, I think in 1981 or so, patented the cell line. It's the Mohs cell line. And apparently it was licensed. It made IL, what was it? It was unique for making IL-2 or something like that. And who's my scientist here? Anyway. I'm sorry?
Don't remember.
I think it was IL-2. And, looking to it, it was very protective. I mean, the fact that his very severe cancer went into remission in the way it did was really kind of unique. And at the time, he sued for lack of informed consent and for conversion. So conversion in property law is this idea that you're taking something that belongs to somebody else and you're taking it for your own benefit. And California courts, it actually went up to the Superior Court, the Intermediate Court of Appeals, and the court held that, yes, people have a property interest in their tissues that they've given to somebody else for research or whatever, for clinical purposes, and they have a property interest, and therefore his property was converted, therefore he has a right to claim anything that was, any benefits, financial benefits that were flowing back to UCLA and the doctor named Gold, for that line. And apparently Gold had gotten like $250,000 grant from a company who was going to license the Mohs cell line, and there may have been some more money in the pipeline someplace. It turned out that in the complaint, they alleged that the cell line was worth $3 billion, and so ultimately at some point. It turned out that wasn't true by a long stretch, and it turned out not to be, I guess, therapeutically of any value at all. Anyway, the Court of Appeals decision was appealed to the California Supreme Court in around 1997 or so, and the California Supreme Court reversed it and basically said, you don't have a property interest, you've given it away, you've basically relinquished all claims to this stuff. That, from a human subject's perspective, that doesn't really mean anything, of course, because you just still have, if it still has your name attached to it, then it's still an issue. But yet they did hold that it was a matter of informed consent. And the problem with the informed consent claim is that wouldn't let Moore get at the value, the ultimate underlying value of those tissues. He appealed that decision to the United States Supreme Court, which refused to hear the case. I think it was retried, and he either lost or got a pittance, some kind of like dignitary harm. He basically didn't get anything at the end of the day. Anyway, so that was Moore. And then in the 90s, the NIH patented the Hegahy. So we had the Havasupai and the Hegahy. Hegahy was the Papua New Guinea. It was a single individual, so it turns out that there was a tribe, also an indigenous tribe, that they were infected. There was a large, high rate of infection of HTLV, human T-cell leukemia virus, and these people did not get sick. So they patented the cell line from this one single individual from Papua New Guinea, and it was the NIH who did it. And then it kind of hit the press, and the NIH actually then declaimed, and I think the patent was allowed to lapse. The one researcher, I think, let her interest be assigned. She couldn't really do that. The United States of America had to do it. She worked for the NIH. But she basically, I guess the NIH agreed that it would be just kind of like the patent would just go, wouldn't be enforced and lapse. So that was, that raised the case, and you're basically patenting this individual again. The NIH wasn't going to be into that. Of course, you know, that doesn't really infringe on any of the rights of the individual. Although the individual's blood was taken, they created a cell line, and he, it was a he, at least, didn't get buckets out of it. There was another case. Is this interesting? Is it okay? Okay. This is talking about benefits, since you segued me into money.
I didn't imply money.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but this is kind of like, this is relevant.
Right, I mean, in the sense that...
Don't take me off, don't take me off course yet. I'm on a roll.
On a roll.
Because it is relevant to the Havasupai. Anyway, so this one was a company called Sequinom back in the mid-90s, working with an asthma research unit at the University of Toronto, went down to Tristan da Cunha, which is a little tiny island in the middle of the South Atlantic, halfway between one continent and the other continent. Apparently there was a shipwreck there 300 years ago, a British shipwreck. There were seven survivors or something like that, and these seven survivors have now had 300 progeny, all can come from those seven founders, and they have about a 50 or 60% rate of asthma in the population. So these guys went down there and they collected blood from about 50% of the people. I don't think they paid them, they just went and kind of like took their blood and went home. They found a gene, and so this was Sequinom. Sequinom patented it and licensed it for $70 million to Boehringer Ingelheim for development of therapies based on that. I don't think it ever produced anything. Anyway, that was ultimately, the patent was ultimately licensed to another biotech. If anybody wants to see these things that are here. But, you know, the people, it's like, well, what is the population supposed to get from that?
There's a whole population of Iceland, and there's that, and there's a company called Decode.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, I know Decode well.
There you go. I don't think they're getting any financial benefits.
I'm sorry?
I don't think the Icelandic people are getting...
Well, it's Decode, part of the Decode. So Decode had two parts. I've known a lot about Decode. I did a project funded by them some years ago. But Decode, so Decode Genetics was a company that was started by an Icelander who had trained at Harvard and went to the University of Chicago and then went back to Iceland to kind of found Decode Genetics. And their basic idea was there was two things. One was simple genetic discovery research using the kind of like, they have a nationalized healthcare system, so they had good networks of physicians and ready access to data that... Actually, their computerized data really goes back to the mid-80s, so they have really good data and on patients. And half the population lives in Reykjavik, so most of the people in Reykjavik are treated at the university hospital there, so they have really good population coverage from this one institution. Anyway, Decode went back and they wrote a law that they got passed and signed into being that allowed the government to create a database or to license a database. And they didn't name Decode as the licensee apparent, but it was all kind of understood since Decode wrote the law. And part of what they were doing is the database essentially was going to link up a very rich genealogy that Decode was building to a genetic database that they were going to build by collecting blood samples on what they estimated to be about 10% of the population, connected that to the medical record. So both the current medical record, plus they also said that they would go backwards in time and code, basically build a big medical record system and go backwards in time, I think 15 or 20 years, to try to like computerize all of their medical records. So they would basically be able to link these up into what's called the GGPR, the genealogy, I forget what GGPR stood for. And that would essentially allow them to study the effect of genes on disease and on drugs as well. They could release a drug into the population and then watch side effects and the like permeate, and then they could go gene discovery and just go looking for genes in the population. Well, it's actually, it's largely homogenous. The population there were three different settlements, really. It was Nordic originally in the year 970, and then there were various raids from the Celts. And then, in fact, at one point, the Portuguese showed up and took a bunch of slaves, and they took them down to the Azores. Someplace down there. Maybe there's another island where there are Icelandic slaves. I forget where it is. And then in the 80s, apparently the country, I forget why, but they brought in 400 Filipino women. So it is largely homogenous. and the genealogies are fascinating. They can, literally, the Kauri Stefansson, the president of the company, can trace himself back to the year 990 or something like that. Yeah. And they have it, when you look at the name in genealogy, oftentimes has a couple of layers, like two or three layers, you go back two or three generations. These guys have circles like 11, 12 generations back. It's fascinating. And in Iceland, they say everybody's related to everybody else, which is kind of true. Especially because there's been what have been natural pinch points in the population. So one was, there was a bad volcano eruption that wiped out the crops, that wiped out the sheep, that wiped out the people. That was, in the 17th century. Then there was another pinch point as well. And so the population shrinks, and then, of course, as it grows again, it reduces the gene pool, so it makes it even more homogenous. And anyway, so the DECODE was doing, they were trying to work on that project, and they were also doing gene discovery in the old-fashioned way. They had developed kind of relationships with clinicians in various diseases. They wound up doing, in fact, discovery on breast cancer. They were part and parcel of a team that discovered BRCA2, breast cancer gene 2. And their agreement, they wound up licensing some of their discoveries prospectively to not Novartis, it's the Swiss or the Swedish.
Novo Nordisk?
No.
No.
One of the other drug companies, the European drug companies, that's also here. But they licensed them, and under that agreement, the drug company said that if we do any drug discovery based on the genes that you license to us, the Icelandic people will get it either free or at cost. So there was some kind of offer back. Anyway, the big thing was that in some sense, the gene discovery they were doing, they were actually getting consent from people. They were doing standard kind of gene discovery research with using these big families. This other project, the GGPR thing, was actually challenged in courts, and in 2003, the Supreme Court tossed it for privacy grounds. Basically, it was using a presumed consent model. You could opt out, but you could only opt out, I think, You could opt out of their medical record being used on a case-by-case basis. Every time you went to the doctor, you could sign a form that says, I don't want my medical information being used. But you couldn't opt out of the genealogy, because everybody's in the genealogy, right? And you couldn't, what else couldn't you opt out of? Yeah, that was the big piece. So everybody was kind of in. Right? So
and what was thrown out, John?
I'm sorry?
What was thrown out, did you say?
This whole law was invalidated by the Supreme Court. On privacy grounds.
Of Iceland.
Yeah, but the DECODE still exists. DECODE, their research has actually been fairly mainstream. They wound up suing CHOP a couple of years ago. There was a guy named Hakanarsson who came here. He had trained here, and then he went back there to work for DECODE, and then he came back here, and they accused him of taking their proprietary software or something like that. And so they sued and settled with no claim of wrongdoing or anything.
But so the opt-out wasn't deemed acceptable on privacy group?
Yeah, well, the opt-out wasn't really thorough. But really, I think the challenge that won the day was a young woman who sued her father was dead. And once he was dead, he couldn't opt out. And she couldn't opt out for him. So I think she was the plaintiff that won and took it to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I think there was another plaintiff who sued on his or her own behalf. And I don't think that one won because they couldn't opt out. But the thing that they missed was is that if you're in the genealogy and you're related to everybody else and you're in this project, you're in there. You know, we can't take you out. It was fascinating. I mean, we went to Decode and they had the genealogy up. And he said, and here's the president. You know, kind of press the button. There's the president. And there's the president's family. And of course, the president is Carrie Stephenson's like third cousin. It was really fascinating. But there was some, at least in some of the licensing agreements, there was some kind of offer back. There was also an interesting, because we followed the literature and kind of the reasons people were participating, and Iceland was actually kind of interesting. It was like, they thought that this was their contribution to the world. You know, so it was like, you know, thinking about benefit, it's like, well, they were, you know, in an altruistic way, they were getting some benefit from it, that they were contributing gene discovery to the world's knowledge base, which I thought was nice. Which then, of course, you know, for those who did not like it, I mean, there was a whole organization called Manvern that was fighting the database project, and it's like, well, are they not altruistic? what do they want out of this? And is it really privacy grounds, or is it a return of benefits? And I never actually, unfortunately, I didn't take the opportunity to engage them more fully on what it was that they thought the real problems were. I knew what the problems were in privacy, but I didn't know what it would take to convince them otherwise. But then there's been discovery. I mean, there's been gene discovery in other places as well. You know, basically targeting some small populations where you have good access to medical record data. And there was a project in Sardinia. I don't know whatever happened to that one. There was a project in, I'm going to blank on the name of it, in a small town in Sweden, Uma, Sweden. So there's a hospital. There's a Ministry of Health, and a company was formed, Unan Genomics, which had licensed the data. In fact, I think they had blood on everybody for some reason, because everybody had been ultimately treated in the hospital, so they had this vast collection of bloods, and which so did Iceland. And they were going to link it up with the medical record data from the ministry and from the hospital and the payment information from the ministry, and it was going to become this research tool. And it's always a big question is like, well, what does the community get out of this? You know, I mean, there was also another one, everybody heard of the, hit a warm spot for me here. The Framingham Heart Study.
Yes.
Anybody heard of this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no? So this is the Framingham Heart Study was a longitudinal study begun in the 50s, I believe. And in fact, Art Kaplan, I think, is in the Framingham Heart Study that families were enrolled and longitudinally followed for years and years and years. They collected blood and everything else and information from them. They saw these people regularly. And about 10 years ago now, it's a while ago now, a company called Framingham Genomics was created by, you know, it was basically a startup to try and get a license, an exclusive license. They had to be an exclusive, of course, from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, which owned the data. Through Boston University to basically mine this resource. And ultimately NHLBI just balked and said, no, we're not going to give you an exclusive. And of course they wanted an exclusive. I mean, you've got this, you know, population catchment of several thousand people, longitudinal data and all kinds of medical records on these people. It'd be a pretty useful tool. And they're, in some ways, you know, the NHLBI is not going to put up the $100 million or however many hundreds of millions of dollars it would cost to actually mine this. And a biotech was willing to do it, but it needs exclusivity to the fruits of that. And what would its obligation be back to the people? Did it make any promises? I mean, in some sense, I said what I argued for them was, like, give 50% of the stock. You know, you're a startup. Right? Give 50% of the stock to the people.
It could be worthless, or it could be worth a lot.
Exactly, right. And the funny thing is a lot of this gene discovery, a lot of biomedical research goes on, and they could pay. They could, you know, give you a share of stock. You're giving me your blood, and somehow we kind of like treat blood as less valuable than the others, than the scientific know-how or the dollars that go into the research. And it's like, well, wait a minute. I got the blood. In fact, I already argued this with respect to Canavan disease. You guys know Canavan? You really want to go down this path? Okay. We're there. Let's go. Let's finish the path. So this was research that was done at the at a Miami Children's Hospital, and I was somewhat conflicted because I was hired by the families who were had research done upon them and had the patent enforced against them to kind of like advocate for them in front of the hospital, with the hospital. That didn't work, so the families wound up suing. They sued originally in Illinois because that's where all the research started. They wound up moving to the good old state of Florida, where a state judge held that for doing research on children doesn't require informed consent under state law. Anyway, and the case went away. So it was a guy who had two children with Canavan disease. Canavan is a leukodystrophy. It basically causes brains of children, afflicted children, to turn to mush fairly quickly. It's called floppy head disease because the first indication that a kid has it is when they're about 6 months old. Instead of being able to pick their heads up, they can't, and they just kind of lose control from there. They typically die by the time they're 7 to 8 or 9 years old. They can't live longer if the care is provided for them. And it's not clear that there's anything going on upstairs with these kids. Anyway, this researcher, this guy with the two kids in Chicago, approached this researcher at the University of Illinois named Ruben Madelon and asked him to do some research on this. Ruben Madelon was not a geneticist. During the course of this, Madelon moved to Miami Children's Hospital and worked from memory here. And he hired a geneticist, and he had a genetics PhD student named, doesn't matter what his name was. This is really digging into my memory banks. But they wound up doing research on these kids. So they had basically really good family information. A lot of the families were providing information, and they were providing money to support the research as well. And in fairly short order, they were able to isolate the enzyme deficiency and the gene that was responsible for that. It's a shortage of an aspartoacylase enzyme, and the ASPA gene, I think, is responsible for it. Is mutated in these kids, or both copies are. And anyway, the institution patented the gene in late 1997. So meantime, once they had discovered it, the families, especially one of the funding agencies up in New York, started providing free Canavan screening to populations in New York. And also an organization called Doria Sharim, which is a TASAC screening organization in Brooklyn run by a rabbi. He added TASACs, and he added Canavan disease to his TASACs, and they also did testing for CF, Niemann-Pick disease, and some other Jewish genetic diseases. And he wound up adding Canavan to that panel. The patent issued, and the people who were doing this in New York got letters of infringement, basically telling them to stop doing it. I actually had I met with a guy from Hopkins who said, without a doubt, that enforcement of the patent led to children being born with Canavan disease, a devastating disease. Anyway, the hospital, so what had happened in reality was that the hospital was a little bit money grubbing. They had created a research institute. They'd brought Ruben Madelon in to kind of be the star of the place. Madelon hadn't really produced much. He'd never gotten an NIH grant in his life, which is kind of strange if you can hire somebody, get somebody who knows what they're doing. He was not a geneticist, but what he had done is because they were able to isolate the aspartoacylase enzyme, he came up with a biochemical test that he thought might be able to predict prenatally if the kid's going to be infected or not. And he wound up doing this prenatal test for the couple that had originally come to him, and he said it's a healthy child. They had the baby, it was a healthy child. And he wound up doing, I think, 11 more, correctly calling them as healthy, and then he had a run of 4 negatives, 4 false negatives. Right, and 4 babies were born. There were 4 lawsuits, at least 1 or 2 lawsuits, probably 4 lawsuits that were settled for several million dollars by the Miami Children's Hospital. So in some sense, Miami Children's was looking to recoup their losses. So they thought this patent was their ticket to that funding stream. And they didn't mind enforcing it against the families, the very families that had participated in the research. Anyway, one of the arguments I made was like, you know, the people with the disease are the ones who are really the unique resource here. Yet we treat them as kind of like a kind of not that unique. It's as if the science and the money to kind of do the research and everything else is so special. And it is, and it's the scientists who are rewarded at the end of the day, not the families. And in this case, in fact, the family. You know, the guy who originally approached Ruben Madelon was very germane to that research. I mean, he obviously held out his arm, provided blood, the blood of his kids as well, and his wife. And he, you know, at the end of the day, he had to bring a lawsuit to try to like protect the rights of the community that had been taken by the hospital. Crazy story. But you know, we talk about negotiating kind of like benefits and all up front, and what are people's expectations? I mean, I think expectations comes into a lot of discussions that we can have tonight about this stuff, because it's like, well, what do you expect to get out of this? Isn't gene discovery enough? Isn't that going to help the community? Same with the drug development world. You know, you're going to participate in this, you get a cure. So, yeah, I don't know if I want to go down this path.
No, that's a good path to go down, because you can make that argument about the Framingham scenario.
Right.
You know.
And you could, you know, with Framingham, I mean, it's a longitudinal study. They still have relationships with everybody. If you're going to do it, you know, can't you go get consent from people? Can't you give them a share of stock?
And I think it's because people aren't willing to be creative about it, and they only think about, you know, I need to give back money to these people. Then perhaps it becomes a huge issue. But if you think a little bit more creatively, like maybe in this particular case, the Miami case, that they wanted free screenings for available to community members who are particularly susceptible to this disease. Mm. I have to believe that that sort of rational, that sort of request wouldn't be uncommon in many populations. Not everyone wants money back for their individual or for their community. They want certain things back. Mm. So it's really, one has to be creative on a case-by-case basis and figure out. And it's good to try to do it ahead of time, but I'm not sure that can even be done. So you could place some parameters or milestones in place and say, we'll have to reassess if we reach this stage of the study as to what, you know, what we can give back.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also raises the question, I guess, of what you do under those circumstances. Again, like the Framingham issue is so, you know, what's really due to the Framingham cohort, the Framingham people, for giving a blood sample? You know, are they due a stock, you know, share of stock or something like that, because it's their blood? You know, did the because they could potentially benefit from understanding cardiovascular risk better, and so on and so forth, so they would benefit downstream, potentially. And it certainly was not their know-how that went into it to figure out what to do in the first place with that. Mm-hmm. So it is a, you know, it's a difficult paradigm, I would think.
But one in which we always value know-how or knowledge that we create a lot more, but a lot sort of heavier thumb on that scale than something you might bring to the table.
Don't necessarily disagree with that point, but
it's capital as well, not only know-how.
Right, capital.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, the pharmaceutical company that was created was basically said they were trying to internalize all of the expenditure the NHLBI had made, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars over the last 30 years. They were basically trying to capture it all.
And I'm not necessarily, when you said, I mean, I think they had an argument for an exclusive license if they were going to spend effort, time, money to analyze the data. It's a question of what, I think certainly for optical reasons, if not anything else, should have been set aside so it could seem that something was being done for the people from whom the samples were taken. I mean, you could set up a trust or some such thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the population? What about the rest of us who paid for it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can make the argument that you're, you know, that the any benefit that comes out of it is really sort of in the public domain anyway. Some people may make money off it for a while, but then it, but people ultimately benefit from a public health perspective if that's what the driver is for these things. So that's where sort of the, you know, That's one part of the argument, how that argument can be made.
Yeah, the other side of that coin is, of course, is that, I mean, people of space, I think, is blanking. Sorry, Becky Eisenberg, University of Michigan, argued that given the patents that are owned, so the public pays for these patents, you know, this research that leads to patentable inventions that may lead to a product downstream, but it's patented, and therefore we pay patent rents. Patent rent is it's an economic term for basically the excess profits technically attributable to the intellectual property. We pay those rents, so we're paying twice. We paid for the research, and now we're paying for the product again. So we pay twice for that invention. Problem is that there's no good way to negotiate and keep those prices fair, you know, whatever fair might mean. Mm-hmm. And there was a great case some years ago. Once again, I was conflicted. I worked in 2006. I worked for an NGO in Washington. On the issue of access to medicines in the developing world, and the guy I worked for, Jamie Love, had created a company back in the early 2000s, a nonprofit drug company, and he filed a march-in petition with Harold Varmus, the head of NIH, seeking the government to march in on a product called an Abbott product, HIV drug called Kaletra.
What's a march-in petition?
So march-in, so under Bayh-Dole, Bayh-Dole was the 1980 act named after Birch Bayh and Evan Dole, Bob Dole and Evan Bayh, that Birch Bayh, actually. Funny how the nepotism works. And I just heard that there's another George Bush in the pipeline.
I know, I saw that read the news, yeah. George P. Bush.
George P. Bush.
Yeah.
He's Jeb's?
Jeb's.
Jeb's, yeah. Jeb's son.
I was like, not another one.
Sorry. This political story is coming brought to you.
I'm glad when I talk state of my mind.
Where were we?
March.
Abbott. Bayh-Dole, basically.
I have to say, your friend is intrepid. They're like Martin Rice plus against Abbott. Okay, please.
Okay, we're on. So Bayh-Dole basically said, you know, there was a perceived problem is that there was a lot of stuff that the government was paying for in the 60s and 70s, and that literally inventions paid for by the government that owned by universities were languishing. Actually, it wasn't owned by universities, and there was a real problem, is that inventions made in universities were essentially automatically owned by the government.
Right.
But there was no direct incentive for the universities to file patents and the like, because the patents would be owned by the feds. And then the university, if it was in a particularly good position, could petition the feds to take a license back on that patent. But it was basically not happening. So Bayh-Dole basically shifted ownership and said, if we're receiving federal dollars and grants and the like, you, the institution, have an obligation to seek patents on inventions, and you have an obligation to try to license them. You should prefer U.S. company licensees. You should prefer small firms in licensing. And you should prefer also non-exclusive licensing over exclusive licensing, which is a whole crazy thing.
They were supposed to do that because they could keep the
right.
Benefits.
So yes, and the institution owns it, and the feds retain two rights. One is a worldwide paid-up license to operate for governmental purposes throughout the world, worldwide, right, for free, royalty-free. And the second is march-in. So march-in is basically this process, supposedly, that says, well, look, we paid for it, and if we feel that the patent is not being used or being used in a way that's inimical to the public purpose, we can march-in, take the patent, and grant non-exclusive licenses to work the patent. Right? March-in has never been used in this country. Interestingly, there's also another provision in the federal law that says, I mean, what is a patent? A patent is basically a right to use the government power to protect economic rights to an invention. And it's used the police power to prevent others from making, using, or selling my invention for a period of years. So to the extent that the government is can use police power in a discretionary way, they can always kind of determine what the bounds on that are. So for instance, if they say that, well, I want to take something and use it for military purposes, right, they do. And what you, as a patentee, if they've taken your patent and granted licenses to someone else, in fact, this happens all the time, say, here's, we want to buy this satellite system, right? The satellite system is worth $100 billion or $100 million, whatever. And there are some patents that you have to deal with, but don't worry about it. And Lockheed files, and you know, all the big companies come in, they basically give an application and a proposal, and at the end of the day, whoever delivers the best product for the best dollar wins. And you, as the patent holder, which has some critical technology for this, in this case Hughes, come out and sue the federal government in the Court of Claims, and the Court of Claims will basically can't prevent you, and it's the only area that can't really stop the government from using your patent. I mean, basically, you can stop anybody else from using your patent for the most part. That area of patent law is changing a little bit. But in this area, you can't stop the government. The government's sole obligation is to pay a reasonable royalty as determined by the Court of Claims. And in this one case of a $100 billion satellite system, it was a 1% royalty. This has never been used in the drug realm. It's used by the military every day. And in the drug world, we can't even negotiate prices under subpart D of Medicare, thanks to the pharmaceutical industry. Anyway, getting back to Bayh-Dole and Marchand. So what happened with Kaletra is that there was a researcher within Abbott who was working on some other disease and wanted to do some work on HIV, and he petitioned, he applied for some federal grant. He got the grant, and he wound up developing a booster drug. It's Kaletra's. It was this is too long ago. My memory is kind of fading. Anybody know what? Nobody knows what Kaletra's made of. It's combination therapy. Nobody's going to help me out here.
Can't remember.
Somebody do a quick search. Kaletra. K-E-L-A. K-A-L-E-T-R-A. It's lopinavir was their, I think lopinavir was their basic ARV, which was the so-so drug.
And
ritonavir. Thank you. And ritonavir was the booster drug. So ritonavir is a great drug, right? And when they first came out with ritonavir, it was basically being sold, and people were put on ritonavir and whatever ARVs, the antiretrovirals that they were already on. So they would be on a Merck ARV and the other drug. When Kaletra, this combined therapy, was licensed, the day after that, Abbott raised the price of ritonavir by a factor of 5. So it went from basically being like, I forget, it went from like $2,000 a year to $10,000 a year, something like that, which basically priced people out and forced people off of their existing therapies, their existing, you know, ritonavir plus whatever they were on, and onto Kaletra, and that's why they did it, right? So it turned out that the ritonavir and the combination therapy had acknowledged federal funding, right? This one grant to Abbott, and so Jamie, in his wisdom, filed a petition for Marchand, basically saying, look, this is being used in a way that's controlling the market, and it's, you know, it's basically kind of like kicking people off their existing therapies, which they might be doing very well on, and it's either that or going to very expensive, you know, make it really expensive for them, and it's being done purely for the fact that purely to force people onto Kaletra, right? And the final decision, the drug's available. That's the standard. And that was Varmus, and you know, Varmus's staff, I guess, really. And that was, so you know, Marchand is a very ineffective tool, and the standards, at least in the drug world, are really, really shaky. So, where's that leading? Glad you asked that question.
Yes, I did.
Okay, that was Marchand, and Kaletra, and patents. Maybe I need a break.
Can you start from?
Pardon?
No.
So anyway, reactions?
Yeah, I think we started by framing him. That's where we started.
Yeah.
Who's owned what?
Yes. But I mean, it does. I mean, you're right in a way, because is there a way to kind of like be inventive? But it's also, I mean, in some ways, it's like, what is this worth? What is your participation worth? What is a fair, I mean, kind of use the vernacular of the reading study, what is a fair benefit? And what are people, and expectations matter as well, I think, you know, especially if it's not negotiated up front. I think it becomes really problematic because you really have no idea what expectations are, and expectations are likely to be dashed because people are going to come to it with different wishes, which is, I guess that's part and parcel of what this whole course is about, is discussing this stuff up front.
Particularly if your life doesn't exist in a research and medically rich, you know, landscape, because you're really not likely to receive the benefits indirectly, if at all. If you're in some remote area where there are no medical facilities, or very little few, little in the way of medical facilities, really. I mean, I guess the case, and we'll probably discuss the case study at some point, but that's sort of, to me, a good example where you're doing research that's specifically related to a disease that would help the population, and yet the possibility of getting the treatment to them seems quite remote.
But why?
Why, as a practical
matter? Why is it remote?
In the case today?
Well, do you want to go there, or do you want to just talk more generally?
I think you have to have certain participants other than the subject participants, and other than the sponsor, and other than the researcher, willing and able to want to make benefits available.
If they can. I mean, there's all kinds of, I mean, reasons. It can be structural, it can be economic. I mean, structural and economic here as well. I mean, there are poor people here who, you know, their care is limited, or they kind of go to ERs when desperate.
I sort of believe that the can depends on who the subject participants are in a real world context. How much you're willing to do for someone depends on who it is you have to, which is why I get back to that article about how the supply and this whole discussion about their economic standing and how that's what allowed them to bring certain claims or use existing law to their favor and assert certain rights.
That's an interesting point. I mean,
and there's certain acceptance that if you're not in that position and you don't know what your rights are, you know, I'll tell you to a certain extent, but I really don't have much of an obligation beyond a certain point.
You've been a civil rights, a human rights lawyer. I mean, what is the role of advocacy in I mean, how many people, you know, are we just seeing the tip of the iceberg with the cases where people have the resources to access the advocates to advocate on their behalf? Necessarily?
It's been evolving around the typical cases that people don't have. It's not only resources, but the social and political infrastructure isn't there to assert those rights. Mm-hmm. That's what came to my mind is, you know, in many of these situations that I look at, you have like the Ministry of Health that is the only, you know, it is somehow the gatekeeper to whether or not a benefit can be made available on an ongoing basis. So is the researcher now responsible for policing the actions of the government of the other? I mean, it becomes an impossible standard.
Yeah, I think actually in the group paper, the moral standards paper, they actually talk about the fact that you can't hold them, you can't really contractually bind them to doing anything. That's the political reality, anytime. So do we want to take a break? I've been speaking too much. Can we take 5 minutes? I need to get my head back in.
called it?
I'm always. And then when I leave here, you know, I always will be off. You mentioned that last semester, actually. I didn't remember all the details, but I do remember from the chain.
And it's good for the problems. Because I just decided not to have a little bit.